Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Film Club episode 21. Apologies if I sound a little snuffly and stuffed up, but you have caught me on the best day of a bad week of fluiness and illiness. It seems to be going around, and I think I've caught the germs of Dan.
Oh, sorry.
It's alright. But I'm not going to blame him because, it's just germs and that's life. As it is, we are here to talk about, as usual, films, and in particular, this week's film is Pan's Labyrinth. But as you may have guessed, I am joined, as I always am, by Mr. Daniel Seraph. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, thank you. Just finally got rid of the cold that I've passed on to you, so sorry about that, Mal.
Hopefully, listeners, we won't pass it on to you through the medium of the internet. We'll try not to, anyway. If I have to cough, I will cough away from the microphone, just in case.
That's very vulnerable.
So, Pan's Labyrinth, which was my last pick, it is our 20th film. Can you believe we've done 20 already?
No, it's flown by.
I know. It's pretty incredible, but we are 20 films deep, and this was my latest pick. Kind of going back to what listeners probably will associate my kind of film taste with, weird, dark, strange, somewhat abstract, and slightly obtuse, but hopefully interesting. You've seen Pan's Labyrinth before. I think we established on the last show that this was, and I'm paraphrasing to quote you, which is quite meta of me considering I'm quoting from a source within the show, that this is one of the films that kind of made you kind of look deeper into films, that kind of made you fall in love with cinema a little.
It was, yeah. I first saw the film when I was, I guess I would have been 16 when it came out in cinemas, so that was when I first saw it. And when you're 16 years old, like I didn't, it's not that I had a bad taste in films. I hope that I don't. But I've liked things like, The Usual Suspects and Pulp Fiction, and they are good films, but the kind of the films that anyone can get into. You don't have to be a cinephile to like those kind of films. And I just, films for me were things with cool stories and, good characters, and that was about it. And I saw Pan's Labyrinth when I was 16. I have no idea why. It really wasn't my kind of thing. I'd never seen a foreign language film before. And there was something about Pan's Labyrinth that just kind of captivated me. Like I came out of the film kind of thinking, I really want to know more about, filmmaking as an art. I think it was, you see all this kind of great production design, and there are so many kind of layers to the film, and the writing's so good, and the design of the creatures in Pan's Labyrinth is so amazing that you kind of, at least I came away kind of thinking, I want to know more about this. I want to know more about the guy who made this. I want to know more about Spanish cinema and foreign cinema. Right? It really kind of, it just kind of ignited, my passion for film. And it's not, I don't think it's one of the best films I've ever seen, but certainly when I was 16 and I hadn't seen anything like this before, it was kind of like, wow, this is what, this is what movies can do. So yeah, it was kind of one of the first ones that really opened me up to this world of film.
It's kind of interesting, because it's interesting to kind of trace to a point of where you kind of expanded your cinematic repertoire, as it were. How does it compare now to like those feelings and whatnot that you first had when you first saw it?
Well, like I said, I don't think it's, when I first saw it, I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Now that I've gone through a lot more of films, I don't think it is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. That said, I still really enjoyed it. I haven't seen it for so long, and I forgot, some of the things that really, some of the things that really captivated me that first time. I was again wowed by seeing it again this week for Film Club. And I also found like some new things about the film which I hadn't seen before. Which is really interesting. So, like I said, like now I've been through a lot more films and I've kind of expanded my film viewing from being 16. It isn't as great as I once thought it was, but it's still, I mean, it's still a really, really interesting, really, really well-made film.
And I would say the same. I think obviously when you see something of this caliber, when you see something within this nature, obviously the first time you see it, it's going to have a greater effect. But having said that, it still, to me at least, is very impressive and still very effective filmmaking. Kind of touching on one of the things that you brought up initially was with this sort of art direction and the way the creatures are designed and just the general aesthetic of the film. I mean, for a film with, I'm guessing, not a massive budget to it, and from, somebody who in certain like mainstream cinema certainly wasn't very well known at all. I think he'd maybe done Blade 2 before this, and I think that's probably what he was most known for. But this was more of his own source material, as it were. Considering that there wasn't a huge budget behind this and there wasn't that much hype behind it and sort of backing and power to have it done, I think it looks fantastic. And I think the art direction of the film still really sticks out in the best possible way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it is a low budget film, at least it seems to me. I mean, I noticed that they do a lot of like day for night photography, and it's obviously kind of made with budget constraints. But that said, you just see so much of kind of Guillermo's creativity and imagination come like alive on screen that you just get so kind of wrapped up in this kind of wonderful world that he creates. You know, he obviously does have such a vivid imagination and such a talent for bringing them to life. And you know, I mean, especially with some of the kind of iconic creatures of the film, you know, like the fawn and the pale man who comes in like halfway through the film, like the terrifying pale man. You know, he like I say, he just has this very vivid imagination, and bringing it to life, he's very skilled at. Despite, you know, not having perhaps the budget that certain Hollywood directors would have.
Watching Pan's Labyrinth again, it made me wonder, because obviously you see Guillermo's name attached to many things. You know, he presents, he's produced this, he's helped get this made. He's very much kind of been an enabler and a very kind of selfless body in the industry, which is kind of a rarity. And it kind of made me wish that he wouldn't be so selfless and that he actually would make more stuff of his own. Because you see that he obviously has a very vivid and somewhat dark imagination, to say the least. But it is very vivid nonetheless, and he clearly has these strong mental images in his head as he's kind of writing these characters and writing these scenes and whatnot. And it made me, when watching it again, kind of go, I know he's got a Pacific Rim, not Pacific Rim, I don't know what that is. He's got Pacific Rim coming out this year. But that will be like his first film since Hellboy 2, I think, which was about 4, maybe even 5 years ago. And I'm like, oh, it's a shame that he hasn't actually done more, because especially with like the caliber of the stuff in this film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he has kind of taken more of a producer's role, which is a shame because, like you said, he is such a talented filmmaker. And he has such a distinctive style, and I mean, it's great that he's kind of passed on this kind of wisdom and what he can bring to film to other people who may not have had that chance. But you know, it is kind of a shame when you look back at Pan's Labyrinth and you think, you know, especially with so many films trying to be Pan's Labyrinth right now. I know the reason you chose this is to kind of prove that you can do dark fantasy. In the wake of things like Snow White and the Huntsman, which were terrible to say the least. And it kind of feels like, you know, we really need someone like Guillermo del Toro to come along at the moment and kind of show you how it's done again. Hopefully he will do it with Pacific Rim, but it's a shame that he's been away for so long.
One of the things that kind of made me pick this in to kind of go with that point of showing that you can do sort of fantasy in a dark and sort of surreal way, and make sort of more childlike stories, more adult orientated, was the fact that this film is incredibly tonally consistent. I mean, it has moments, and I think in particular it has an over sort of arcing sense of triumph, especially towards the end, even though that the conclusion comes at a very dark price. There is an overarching sense of triumph and sort of enlightenment, but yet tonally throughout the film it's incredibly bleak and it's incredibly dark, but it manages to be consistent and precise to that point. Whereas I think a lot of films that like you mentioned, that terrible Snow White film,
Exactly.
tries to employ a sense of, ooh, this is a bit dark, this is a little bit edgy, and it doesn't really fully commit. And whereas I feel this certainly does commit, not only just in the actual story, but the creatures, the art direction, as we've mentioned, but also just the general aesthetic of the film. I mean, it has this very weird and sort of alluring blue-green tint to the colouring of the film all the way through it, pretty much. And it fits, and it kind of fits the tone, because it's dark, but yet it's not pitch black. You know what I mean? The shades of colour. And I think the actual presentation of the film really fits with the tone of what's going on, and again just shows that extra commitment into making the film work.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I couldn't really say that myself. Like, I think it kind of makes Snow White and the Huntsman and those kind of dark fantasy movies, quote unquote, so bad, I think, is that, like you said, they don't get that kind of balance right between bringing kind of fantasy to life and then doing it in such a dark way. And it ends up kind of coming off a bit goofy and silly. But Guillermo del Toro is so skilled in it, just in, you know, like you said, in kind of controlling that whole mood and tone of the film, that he, you know, he just brings it all together, the whole balance of that so well. You do have this kind of childlike fairy tale story going on with Ophelia, but then you bring in so many dark themes kind of under the surface and, you know, straight to the surface in some instances. And yet it's still, you know, it still remains so consistent, like you say. And he manages to just get that balance so perfectly well. And, you know, that is a sign of a great filmmaker for me. And at least I'm great filmmaking in Pan's Labyrinth. And it's what makes a film so effective and so good.
One thing that really worked for me in the film, and I mean, it's something that I thought was really interesting the first time I saw it, but it's something that has kind of strengthened on watching it again, is the sort of juxtaposition of you have this sort of fantastic element to it, where it is this sort of mythos of creatures in the labyrinth and the legend and all that kind of interesting stuff, but to kind of go against that, you have this very real, very human side to the story, which is set during the Spanish Civil War, and you have people fighting and you have people dying for their causes and what they believe in, and you have this real interesting crossover where you have monsters sort of residing in the realm of the labyrinth, and yet you have monsters in the human world as well through the captain. And I thought that was a really interesting crossover, and it's something that could have easily played against each other in a bad way, but I think they mesh pretty well.
See, this was the thing, when I kind of came to revisit Pan's Labyrinth, I was a little bit concerned that, you know, I really like the film as this kind of mix of fantasy and politics going side by side, and I couldn't really remember, you know, how well they would overlap, you know what I mean? I didn't know if they would kind of feel a bit too, well, this is a fantasy part and this is a politics part. But, you know, when I watched it again, I was just so surprised that, you know, it does work so well. And it is because, you know, the narrative does give it this great crossover between, you know, the two. Both in terms of tone, like we talked about, and kind of thematically as well, you know, because they're both kind of tied together by this kind of idea about the power of fantasy in a way, you know, be it this little girl's fantasy of this world where she can kind of be away from her cruel father and be a part of these great adventures, or be it, you know, this kind of fantasy of making Spain a better place, which is kind of what the Marxists have, you know, in fighting Captain Vidal. And so there is this kind of, you know, there are so many times when it kind of overlaps and it kind of comes together so well. And especially because, you know, it's all kind of tied together with Ophelia as the central character, and she kind of walks this very, she kind of walks this line between those two worlds. You know, on one hand, you have these fantasies that she engages in, but then they also kind of teach her to be brave and kind of give her independence and ultimately kind of keep Mercedes's secrets from her new father, and therefore she kind of gets kind of drawn into this political world in much the same way that kind of Mercedes has as a character. And so, you know, there's this kind of like little ways that it overlaps, you know, her own kind of rebellion and the way that, you know, that kind of complements and contrasts like the rebellion of the Marxists against the captain. And you know, it just works so well on so many levels, the way he kind of brings these two very conflicting stories and ideas together. You know, you never thought that fantasy and monsters and creatures and giant frogs would complement a story about, you know, 1944 fascist Spain so well, but it does because of those, you know, those ideas.
It's interesting that you bring up the point that the whole adventure that Ophelia goes on is definitely, it's kind of like a learning curve, because it's kind of teaching her to be independent, because clearly her mother's in a bad state, as it were, and whatnot, and she faces a future where she could possibly have to sort of live the rest of her childhood underneath the watch of Vidal, and yet it kind of teaches her strength and courage, and it's really a wonderful sort of counterpoint to everything that's going on. And one of the things that I think that crosses over, and I don't know if it's just me seeing this, but I think there's strange similarities between Vidal and between the Fawn, in the sense that they seem like very mirrored versions of a father figure. He's very much trying to control her, Vidal. And in a sense, the Fawn is as well, but he's doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah, I also kind of see a lot more. I kind of see more similarities between Vidal and the other monsters in the film really. I kind of see Videl more like the kind of pale man creature. He's sort of, he's sort of this kind of terrifying, kind of possessive villain, at least kind of through Ophelia's childlike eyes. And I guess probably the reason why I kind of feel that way is because you have that. You know, that scene where she draws the chalk wall and goes down into that pale man's lair, and it's sort of all kind of it runs parallel to that scene where Vidal is sat at kind of the head of the table with the Catholic priest and with Ophelia's mother. And you know, there is this kind of weird kind of juxtaposition between the two scenes. It sort of seems to hint that, you know, they are both these kind of same kind of characters. They're both this kind of dominating head of the table kind of figure who is sort of this big kind of oppressing figure in Ophelia's life. And I kind of feel like he's more pale man than Orm. I guess that's just me.
Yeah, no, I mean that's totally cool. I mean that's the whole reason we made Film Club was to kind of see different interpretations of stuff, and that's the thing with a film like this. I think there is a, although a lot is clearly and distinctively drawn out. You know, clearly bad guys are bad guys. This is not Chinatown. This is not where the lines merge. You know, things are very distinct, but at the same time, because it uses the sense of imagination and it's Gilmore's imagination used to fuel the film, it gives enough breathing room for you to use your own imagination and interpret things, and I think that's what makes it work equally as well as a film about real life problems as it is a film about, you know, fantastical problems as well.
Yeah, speaking of which, one of the things that I've always kind of felt about Pan's Labyrinth is I definitely feel like there is some kind of connection between those three kind of tasks that Ophelia
Oh,
does
yeah.
in relation to her kind of real life problems. But I've never been able to quite figure out what they are in a way. Like I said, I sort of feel like the Pale Man is sort of this kind of fantasy manifestation of the Captain. But then, you know, for example, I don't really know what the frog scene means, and the way that that ties into Ophelia's real life problems with, you know, fascism and her father. And I've tried to figure that out so many times, and you know, even seeing it again recently, I don't really quite get it. I mean, I know that there's something there because it's full of this odd, like, weird sexual imagery. Like the whole tree looks like this giant uterus, but then it always stumps me, pun intended. Just like what that means to up to Ophelia's story. I don't know if you had any theories on that, or even the final one, you know, where she takes her brother to be sacrificed, essentially.
Well, I mean, I suppose the sense that, you know, there's a lot that could be read into it. I mean, she, as you said, she does take her brother to be sacrificed, and it's essentially her giving up her childhood, I guess, because she does face a life without her mother, and you know, she kind of faces losing her innocence, I guess, in a sense. And perhaps, you know, the three different tasks are to represent three different stages of life, you know, like childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. And perhaps, you know, by completing all three, she is excelling and accelerating to adulthood. And maybe that's what the killing of her baby is supposed to be, but she isn't prepared to give up her childhood. She isn't prepared to be forced out of her willingness to kind of grow up. She wants to sort of live the life of a child, and she wants to live a normal life, and she won't be backed into a corner by the situation and by the characters that force the situation, i.e. Videl, and hence why she won't kill her brother, and that's what kind of sets her free, I guess. I mean,
That's a
it's
really interesting theory, because I mean, like I said, there is that kind of sexual imagery at the start, which is almost like this womb, which, you know, sort of, I mean, that definitely gives weight to the idea, you know, that they are these kind of three stages of her childhood, I guess. Yeah, I've never kind of thought of it that way. That's really interesting.
There you go. I mean, that's just what I'm thinking. I might be completely wrong. I mean, perhaps that's what's intended. Perhaps Gilmore had something completely different. Perhaps it actually just means nothing. I don't
Yeah,
know.
that's the thing. I've never quite known whether these are just kind of three fantasy tasks, because I know Guillermo del Toro has always said, you know, he always sees it as kind of, he doesn't see the Ophelia's kind of fantasies as fantasies. He sort of sees it as reality, that she actually is conversing with a faun and doing these three tasks to become a princess. But I don't know. I never really saw it that way. I always kind of felt that, you know, her fantasy really kind of overlapped with her reality. And yeah, they've always kind of confused me the ways that They have, but yeah, I think that's a really interesting theory, that
It's
one.
interesting because you see when she does take her brother to the place where she's supposed to sort of sacrifice him, you see Vidal chase her and the fawn is there but he can't see him. So, you know, it makes you wonder if it is actually happening or if it's, I don't know, like an elaborate aspect of her imagination, or perhaps only she can see the fawn and the rest of the labyrinth.
Yeah, I mean, it does leave it ambiguous. I mean, not that that's a criticism at all. I
Oh,
mean,
no.
it gives a lot more to analyze about the film.
Well, that's what I like about it, because, like I said, you know, even though it clearly defines certain aspects of it, and, you know, the tone is very specific and it's very straightforward in that sense, it does leave things open to your imagination, and, you know, ultimately, you know, imagination and imaginative ideas fuel sort of imaginative ideas of their own, and I like that aspect about it.
Yeah, me too. Another thing that I really liked about the film, watching it again, were the performances. And I didn't quite realize how good they are. I remember being really impressed by them even when I first watched it. But seeing it again, they're so good. Especially Sergio Lopez, who plays Captain Vidal. He's such this kind of cold, evil villain, and he's fantastic in the film.
Well, in a way, is weird. It's like a rich irony in the sense that the human character is actually more monstrous than any of the creatures
Yeah,
involved
that's true.
in the labyrinth. But yeah, no, the performances are fantastic across the board. I mean, even like the more supporting characters, like Mercedes and the Doctor, I think are fantastic as well. And they just really add credence to what's going on, and it also adds a real sense of passion to the humanistic side of the story as well, with her brother out in the woods and whatnot. And I think in other directors' hands, having so much to kind of cram into the space that the film takes up, you could have easily made such a kind of convoluted mess with it, and it could have kind of just been really overly layered and just stacked upon just this really overly broad sense of storytelling. But I think there's such a nice, intricate way that it weaves in between one another, and he spaces the film out really well.
Yeah, another great performance in the film, actually, I've just remembered this, is Doug Jones, who kind of he plays
Yes.
essentially plays the Fawn and the Pale Man. And
Yes.
I guess we almost kind of go back to the art direction thing now, but the thing that's so impressive about the film is that you actually have someone like Doug Jones who kind of helps portray these. And I think it gives the film just such a more unique look, having it done in that kind of style than any of the kind of, Lord of the Rings, Snow White and the Huntsman, the Hobbit kind of things that have come after it, because you have such kind of, I think it really helps that kind of balance between the fantasy world and the real world, because you essentially have that kind of, Doug Jones is that kind of link between the two there.
Yeah, he's definitely the bridge between both. And you know, call me old fashioned or whatnot, but I actually do have a real soft spot for more practical effects. I mean, don't get me wrong, CGI is you know, it's obviously a very helpful thing, and it can make films look fantastic and give them a little bit of gloss and whatnot. But I'm very much a fan of sort of practical effects and things being built and things being used and people being in costumes and stuff. I don't know, it's almost like a romanticism for the kind of old school way of how films were done, and it's nice to see when that's still used, you know,
I
because
agree.
it's nice to see it that it's still got a place and it still works, you know.
That's the thing, and it really shows that it does still work. It doesn't look hokey or silly
No.
at all. Like it does look really, really good. And in fact, it looks better than a lot of the stuff that you could do with CGI, because they are such kind of, human movements and emotions that you see on these characters, these monsters. Yeah, I mean, it really shows that it still works. And I mean, I don't know. I don't know anything about Pacific Rim. I don't know anything about what Guillermo del Toro is planning for the future, but I'd love to see him kind of maintain that style in terms of, how he creates his creatures and monsters, because it's so effective in Pan's Labyrinth.
Well, I mean, if you've never seen Hellboy 2,
Which I haven't.
well, you should, because the thing is, I think it's a really good, it's not just a really good comic book film, but it's actually a really good entertaining film, and it very much kind of keeps his sense of imagination alive. Even though he's using someone else's source material, you very much feel that he has put a lot of his own input into it, and he's kind of been given free rein. And I mean, you can see the sort of stylistic tendencies of Pan's crossing over into Hellboy and Hellboy 2. But even if you just watch the market scene from Hellboy 2, there's a lot of puppetry and animatronics and stuff in it. So if you like that kind of hand-built sort of practical effects, and you kind of like what he's done with that kind of thing in pans, you should definitely check out at least the market scene from Hellboy 2, because there's loads of that going on, and it's fantastic, and all the characters have real personality and whatnot, and it's just fantastic. And like you, I don't really know much about Pacific Rim, except it's got robots in it, and that's about it. And that kind of puts me off a little bit, because you look at, you know, the last few years worth of robotic films, and you've had Transformers, and you've had that boxing film with the robots, and you're kind of like, oh, robots, you generally are pretty cool, but, you know, no one's really done robots very well for a long time. And...
Oh, no. Unless you can put Doug Jones in a robot costume, I'm not really interested.
I'm going to be interested because it's him, and I'm going to always be interested to see what he does, but, yeah, robots kind of... It makes me worry a little bit, but you know, I'll have faith. But yeah, no, I would definitely recommend, if you like this, you should check out Hellboy and Hellboy 2, because they're awesome, and he does his practical magic so well in both of those films, but especially 2. But yeah, so I mean, you had a good time watching it?
I did very much. You know, it's nice to watch a film that you fell in love with so many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's been, what, like 7-8 years since I watched a film now?
Wow.
Not since I watched a film, but since I first watched a film, sorry. Yeah. But it's nice to be reminded that, you know, even though it's been so long since you first watched it, and, you know, I first fell in love with it, that, you know, you can still take so much away from it, and even take new things away from it.
Oh, exactly. You know, you can kind of, I guess, from a wonderful point of view, is having initially never seen something quite like that, and now you've kind of very much expanded your film repertoire in like the number of years between first seeing it. You can kind of see where perhaps influences have come into the film, and where the film itself has maybe influenced other things as well.
Exactly. It's nice seeing it with a different pair of eyes than I did, you know, 7-8 years ago.
Exactly. And hopefully that experience has been pretty much the case for all of you listeners. Or perhaps maybe this is the first time you've seen it, and perhaps you yourself have been somewhat floored by its fantastic magic that it still weaves. So there you go, Pan's Labyrinth. If you want to talk to us about Pan's Labyrinth, you can do so over at Facebook. Go to Screen Invasion group page thingy page. I don't know what page it is. It's on Facebook. You can find it. It's there somewhere. And you can go to the Film Club forums, which I have just updated last week, because we hadn't updated them for a while, but I have fixed that. So you can go and talk about Pan's Labyrinth and any other of the 20 films that we've had in our collection so far, if you are catching up. Or, you know, whatever. Maybe you're not even doing it in order. Perhaps you are going all breathless and just throwing out the rule book. It's a little throwback to an old film we did there. And just doing it in any old willy-nilly order. Who knows? But you can go talk to us about those films and converse with other listeners / viewers over at that there Facebook page. But other than that, it's time to pick the next film. It's time to pick number 21. And this one lies heavily on your shoulders, listeners. Every third round of picks, we do what we call the public pick. Once Dan's picked a film and I've picked a film, we watch them and we've talked about them. For good or bad, we go into the public pick, where you suggest your film titles. We write them on a little bit of paper and then stuff them in a little plastic box, which you can hear right here. And we'll give this little roll around. We'll pull one out and we'll see, by the power of randomness, what the next film is. I actually can't really remember what's in here. I know that we've got Silence of the Lambs in there.
Yeah, that's the Russian roulette bullet film that we've got in there. That's the Silence of the Lambs. We've got Kids in there, I believe.
We do, because on our last episode of the podcast, we were talking about Harmony Korine, and obviously the film Kids came up, which I don't believe you've seen, have you?
I've never seen Kids, no. I wanted to go back and see it because Spring Breakers is out in the UK on Friday, this Friday coming. So I wanted to see it. So maybe that one will come up and it'll be perfectly timed. I don't think we've got Jaws in there as well, I think.
I think we do, yes. I think last time we did an episode of Film Club, we had someone suggest Jaws, which, you know, is always a pleasure. I love Jaws. I could watch Jaws every day, essentially, and never be bored. But there's a few things in there. We've got about just under 10, I think, in the box. But if you want to suggest films for the next public pick, do feel free to do so at the Facebook page or over at Twitter, at twitter.com/invasionradio. Or if you want to send us an email at filmclub@gmx.com. So send in your suggestions and you might have your pick pulled out on the next round of public picks. But for now, let's give the mystical tumbler a shake and see what Lady Luck will have us watching for film number 21. Oh, God, I've dropped the pick. It's on the floor. The pick is on the floor. It's all right. 10-second rule. If I wanted to eat it, but I'm not gonna. And the next pick is... I don't remember writing this down, and I don't know what it is. It's a film called Suck.
Suck. In fact, I know who recommended
from
this
to 2009, us. I've got written in brackets.
Montana Leach recommended this to us, who used to be a guest on our sister podcast, yes. The podcast.
That's right.
He recommended this, and I remember him saying it and me being like, what the hell's that? And I'm still not entirely sure what it is.
Looking up on the IMDb page, it is a comedy. It's under the genres of comedy, horror, and music. It came out in 2009, and the basic premise is it's a comedy centred on a rock and roll band that will do anything to become famous. And it looks a little bit glam metal. There's a man with an eye patch. It is directed and written by Rob Stefanuk. I'm probably pronouncing that all wrong. Let's have a little look. Who is also known for doing Phil Alien, Superstar, and Blown Away. I have no idea what this film is.
I'm just looking at it now, and it's got a kind of bizarre cast, which includes Alice Cooper, Iggy Pop, Henry Rollins, Malcolm McDowell, and Moby.
Okay, and Moby, who plays a character I see called Beef?
Yeah.
Moby Beef.
Moby Beef. I'm intrigued. I'll give Tanner that.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting pick. I mean, I suppose it's a good thing that we know nothing about it, because we'll be both going in with absolute clean slates. As will you, listeners. So there you go, Suck, from 2009. I will put a link to the IMDb page in the show notes. So, and with a trailer as well, so you can get a little bit of a tease before you watch it. But that is going to be film number 21. It's interesting. That's what I like about the public pick, is I completely forget what's in there. And then we get
it's
something.
Nice to pick something out that neither of us know as well, so it's going to be a huge surprise when we see it. So that's pretty exciting.
Exactly.
You know, it could be the greatest thing we've ever seen.
Do you know what? It could be. It could very well be a hidden gem that neither of us would have even known about if Tanner hadn't actually suggested it. So there you go. Suck. It could have come with a better title. I'm being critical already.
Especially when you give that synopsis of rock band that will do anything to become famous.
Exactly.
And its title suck.
I feel like maybe I need to procure this from a specialist shop on that title alone. But, you know, I will not judge it on its title alone until I see the film itself. But, I mean, it seems to have an interesting and strange premise and a strange cast, so you know I'm all for it for that.
Me too, I'm in.
So there you go, 2 weeks time we're talking about Suck and all things interesting around that, so go get yourself a copy. Hopefully we'll all be germ free and we can dissect film number 21, and as I said, if you want to put in your picks, feel free to do so, as well as talk about the previous films we have watched and discussed. But until then, Dan, it's been a pleasure, as always.
And you too.
And we will speak to you again in 2 weeks.